From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The House on Kerwin Street by August Derleth. Being the manuscript of Andrew Phelan. The controversial Phelan manuscript found in the room from which Andrew Phelan so strangely vanished during the night of September 1st, 1938, has at last been conditionally released for publication by the Library of Miskatonic University of Arkham, Massachusetts, which had requested it from the Boston Police Files. It is reproduced here by express permission of Dr. Lanfer of the library staff, with the exception only of certain deletions whose suggestiveness was too terrible and whose concepts too alien to contemporary mankind to permit of publication. Man must be prepared to accept notions of the cosmos and of his own place in the seething vortex of time, whose merest mention is paralyzing. He must too be placed on guard against a specific lurking peril, which, though it will never engulf the whole race, may impose monstrous and unguessable horrors upon certain venturesome members of it. H.P. Lovecraft. It would not be in error to maintain that my recent experiences were direct outgrowth of the advertisement in the personals column of the Saturday Review, for the advertisement was unusual and provocative. I saw it first on a day when I was not certain from what source my next week's board and lodging were coming. It was unpretentious, but there was in it a curious note of challenge which I found it difficult to ignore. I read down the column and came back to it. Young man of brawn, brain, and limited imagination, if with modicum of secretary ability, apply to 93 Kerwin Street, Arkham, Massachusetts, for information which may be of monetary advantage. Arkham was only a few hours from Boston, an old city whose clustering gambrel roofs had once concealed hunted witches whose changelessness lent itself to strange tales of haunts and legends, whose narrow streets along the Miskatonic River were sentient with the very presence of past centuries, of people who had lived there and had been dust for long decades. And it was pleasant to find myself once more within its boundaries early that June evening. I had philosophically packed all such worldly goods as I felt might be necessary to keep me in the position, if I suited the advertiser, until myself knew that I could fill it to my own satisfaction, and I carried them in one stout suitcase, which I checked at the bus station immediately on my arrival there. After a light repast, I sought out a city directory and ascertained the identity of the inhabitant of 93 Kerwin Street, whose name was given as Dr. Laban Shrewsbury. Acting on the intuitive conviction that Dr. Shrewsbury might be a person of some consequence, I took myself to the reference rooms of Miskatonic University and made inquiry, as a result of which I was directed not only to a local file on him, but also to a book he had written and published 2 years ago. The file was informative to an exceptional degree. I learned that Dr. Shrewsbury was a student of mysticism, a lecturer in occult sciences, a teacher of philosophy, an authority on myth and religious patterns of ancient peoples. His book, I am ashamed to confess, was far less informative. It was in large part beyond me. It bore the forbidding title of an investigation into the myth pattern of latter-day primitives with a special reference to the Relyeh text, and the merely cursory glances which I was able to give it conveyed nothing whatever to me, save the fact that my prospective employer was engaged upon some kind of research which ought, if not precisely within my sphere, to be at least not uncongenial to me. Armed with this information, I set out for Kerwin Street. The house I sought differed little from other houses on its street. Indeed, it had so similar an aspect that it might have been one of a row, all designed by the same unimaginative architect and constructed by the same builders. It was large without giving the appearance of largeness. Its windows were casement windows, and small. Its many gables receded into roofs that seemed to sway and sag, and it was weather-stained, without having the appearance of being in sore need of paint. Moreover, it was set between gnarled trees, both of an indeterminate age, but seemingly quite ancient, older in fact than the house, which had about an aura of age that was almost tangible. At this time of the day, the hour was that last hour of dusk, when the deeper twilight invades country lanes and city streets like a kind of just perceptible smoke. The house had an almost sinister appearance, but this I need to be the inevitable effect of the ever-changing light. There was no glow from any of the windows, and I stood briefly on the stoop, wondering whether I might have chosen an inopportune time to call on my prospective employer. But I had not, for even as I raised my hand to knock, the door swung open, and I found myself facing an elderly man who wore his hair long and white, but had neither mustache nor beard, thus revealing a firm, almost small chin, half-pursed lips, and a strong Roman nose. His eyes were not visible at all, for he wore dark glasses with shields, which prevented one from seeing his eyes even from the side. Dr. Shrewsbury? Yes, what can I do for you? My name is Andrew Phelan. I came in answer to your advertisement in the Saturday Review. Ah, come in. You're just in time. I did not attach any significance to this cryptic statement, other than to assume that he had been expecting someone else, as indeed he had, for so he soon informed me, and wished only to say that I came in good time for an interview, before his expected visitor turned up. I followed him into a dimly lit hall, so feebly illuminated that I had to go cautiously, lest I stumble, and presently found myself in the old man's study, a high-ceilinged room which contained many books, not only in shelves, but strewn all over on floor, chairs, and the old man's desk. The professor waved me to a chair and himself sat down at his desk. He began immediately to ply me with questions. Could I read Latin and French? Yes, I could read both languages with some facility. Could I box, and did I know jiu-jitsu? Happily, I had some knowledge of both. He seemed particularly concerned about my imagination and repeatedly asked curious questions which seemed designed to reveal to him whether I could be easily frightened, never once asking me directly. He explained that he had an occasion to pursue his studies in strange, out-of-the-way places, and was often put in some personal danger from roughs and thugs, and for that purpose he required a secretary companion who would act as a bodyguard should the necessity, admittedly remote, arise. Could I transcribe conversation? I believed I could do so reasonably well. He hoped I was familiar with certain dialects and seemed gratified when I revealed that I had studied philology at Harvard. You may wonder, he then said, at my insistence about lack of imagination, but my researches and experiments are of so outre a character that a too imaginative companion might well be able to grasp enough of the fundamentals to suspect the cosmic revelations which might come of my work. Candidly, I must take precautions to prevent anything of that nature from happening. I have been aware for some time of something vaguely disquieting about Dr. Shrewsbury. I could not ascertain what it was, nor what basis it had in my awareness. Perhaps it was that I could obtain no glimpse of his eyes. Certainly it was disconcerting to be faced by those opaque black glasses which gave no hint of sight. But it did not seem to be that. It seemed rather to be something that was almost psychic, and, had I been given to an easy submission to intuition, I would have withdrawn. For there was something markedly strange here. I needed no imagination to sense it. There was an aura of fear and awe about the room in which I sat. Oddly incongruous with a musty smell of books and old papers, and there was above all an insistent and absurd impression of being in a place apart and away from all other human habitation, like a house of dread in a remote forest, or a place of insecurity in a borderline between darkness and daylight, instead of a prosaic old dwelling along one of the river streets in ancient Arkham. Quite as if he sensed this incipient doubt lodged in my mind, my prospective employer delivered himself of some reassurance in the disarming way in which he spoke of his work, seeming to ally us against the predatorily curious world which inevitably imposes upon scholars and savants and casts over all their work and thought the insidious rust of doubt and disparagement. It was because of this, he said, that he preferred to work with someone like myself, who came to him free of any prejudice and would shortly be protected against prejudice. Many of us search in strange places for strange things, he said, and there are aspects of existence about which even the great of our time have not yet dared to speculate. Einstein and Schrodinger have come close among the scientists. The late writer Lovecraft came even closer. He shrugged. But now, to business. Forthwith, he made me an offer of remuneration so tempting that it would have been folly even to hesitate about its acceptance, and I did not. At once upon my acceptance, he gravely cautioned me to speak to no one of anything that might actually happen or seem to happen in this house. For things are not always as they seem, he explained enigmatically, and to know no fear within myself, even if no explanation of events was immediately forthcoming. He would expect me to occupy a room in the house. Moreover, he would greatly like to have me begin work at once, as soon as my bag had been got from its place of storage, and this would be sent for, because he wished as much as possible of the conversation with his expected visitor transcribed. The transcription must be made from the adjoining room, or from another place of concealment, since it was doubtful if his visitor would speak if he suspected the presence of anyone other than his host, who had had the greatest difficulty in persuading him to come up from the port of Innsmouth and pay him this visit. Giving me no opportunity to ask questions, but placing at my disposal pencils and paper, and showing me where I must conceal myself, behind an ingeniously contrived peephole at one of the bookcases, the professor took me upstairs to a small, cramped gable room, which was to be mine for the duration of my association with him. It was flattering. I vaguely felt to have been graduated from a mere secretary companion to an associate, but I had little time in which to ponder this, for I had hardly returned to the floor below when the professor observed that his visitor must be near. Hardly had he spoken when the heavy door resounded to the thud of the knocker, and the professor, motioning me to my place of concealment, went to open it and admit his nocturnal visitor. When my employer first mentioned his coming visitor, I had naturally assumed that it would be someone engaged in similar research. Therefore, I was utterly unprepared for the sight of the professor's guest that I had from my people, for he was by no means the kind of individual I would have expected to see in Dr. Shrewsbury's house. He was still a man on the sunny side of middle age, but this fact was not immediately apparent, for he was swarthy of skin, so swarthy, indeed, that I took him for a Lascar, and it was not until he began to speak that I identified him as of South American origin. He was clearly a sailor, for his garb was nautical, and it was obvious that this was not his first visit with the professor, though equally clear that it was his first call at the house on Kerwin Street. There was a colloquy in tones too low for my hearing, but this was evidently not meant for me, since it was not until the two of them were seated in the professor's study that Dr. Shrewsbury raised his voice to normal volume, and his visitor did likewise. The conversation, I then transcribe, was as follows. "I wish you would tell me from the beginning, Senor Fernandez, what took place last summer." Apparently, disregarding the suggestion, the sailor broke into his narrative in a curious but not illiterate mixture of Spanish and English, at a point where he must have dropped it earlier. "It was night, very black. I was separated from the party, and all the time I walk, I do not know where. You were somewhere in the vicinity of Machu Picchu, according to your map. See, but I do not know where. And afterward, you know, we could not find the place or even the way I took. But then it rained. There I was walking in the rain, and then I thought I heard music. It was strange music. It was like Indian music. You know, the old Incas lived there, and they had... Yes, I know those things. I know about the Incas. I want to know what you saw, Señor Fernandez. I walk all the time. I don't know in what directions or anything. But it seemed to me the music was getting louder, and then one time I thought it was just in front of me. But when I walked that way, I come to a bluff. I could feel it was solid stone. I walk around a little way, feeling along it. Then the lightning flashed, and I saw it was a high hill. Then it happened. I don't know how to say it. Suddenly, the hill did not seem to be there. Or perhaps I was somewhere else. But I swear I had drunk nothing. I was not delirious. I was not ill. I fell down on something, and I was in a doorway. It was rocks that had the shape of a doorway, and there was black water down there, and Indians half-dressed. You know the way they used to dress in the old days of the conquistadores? There was something in that lake. That was where this music was coming from." "The lake?" "Si, senor. From inside the water, from the outside too. There was music of two kinds. One kind was like opium. It was so sweet and intoxicating. The other was by the Indians. It was wild pipe music. It was not good to hear." "Can you describe what you saw in the lake?" "It was big." Here he paused, his brow furrowed. "It was so big, I do not know how to say it. It seemed to be as big as a hill, but of course that cannot be. It was like jelly. All the time it changed its shape. Sometimes it was tall. Sometimes it was squat and fat with tentacles. It made a kind of whistling or gurgling sound. I do not know what the Indians were doing with it. Were they worshipping it? See, that could be it," he seemed excited, "but I do not know what it was." "Have you ever gone back there?" "No. I thought I was followed that time. Sometimes I think so still. We looked next day. Somehow I found my way back to the camp in the night, but we could find nothing." "When you say you thought you were followed, do you know by what?" "It was by one of the Indians." He shook his head thoughtfully. "It was like a shadow. I don't know, maybe not." "When you saw those Indians, did you hear anything?" "See, but I could not understand. It was not in any language I know, only in part their own language. But there was one word, perhaps a name?" "Yes, go on, please." "Chulu. Cthulhu? See, he nodded vigorously. But for the rest, it was just shouting and screaming. I do not know what it was they said. And the thing you saw in the lake, Do you know the amorphous horror god of the ocean deaths? Khan, lord of the earthquake of the pre-Inca people? See. Was the thing in the lake in the semblance of Khan? I do not think so. But Khan had many faces, and what I saw came out of the water. Was it like the devourer, the war god of the Quechua? I take it you have seen the Chavin stone? Our party examined it many times before we went into the Inca country. It is in the National Museum at Lima. We went from there to Manacay and into the Andes for Cusco, then into the Cordillera de Villanueva, to Ollantambo, then to Machu Picchu. If you examined it, you must have noticed that the diorite slab depicts serpents issuing from various parts of the devourer's body. Now, in regard to the jelly-like mass you saw in the subterranean lake, did it not also have appendages on its body? Not serpent, senor. It is only seldom that Viracocha is so shown. But like the thing in the lake, he represents the sea also, as did Khan. Many people say that Viracocha means white foam of the waters. But it had appendages. That's the point I wish to make. See, were you in the vicinity of the fortress of Salapunco when this happened to you? We had gone beyond it. You know how the land is there. The fortress is on the right bank of the river. It is very large, but it is differently constructed from most, since it is built of a large trapezoid granite blocks of graded size and a shape that is uniform, all evenly placed and fitted without use of mortar. The rampart is almost 15 feet high and faces the river. It is below this place, in the terrible and deep gorges of the granite mountains, where live the Quechua Ayars, who built the strange deserted city of Machu Picchu, which stands on the summit of a rocky cliff in a loop of the river. Almost on all sides of it is the deep canyon. We were then approaching this place when we made the camp that night. Two of us did not want to go. One wished to go to Sasahuaman instead, but most of us had set out for Machu Picchu. About how far in miles were you from Salapunco? Perhaps a mile, 2 miles. We were in the low country, and the place was very rocky. The trees and bushes grew thick there. At this point in the conversation, an extremely curious incident took place, which terminated it. Dr. Shrewsbury, his lips half open to ask a further question, was suddenly made aware of something beyond my own consciousness. His head gave an imperceptible jerk, as if he had heard something. His lips firmed shut. He got up and said with pressing urgency to his guests that he must leave with the utmost secrecy, and he must take elaborate care not to be seen on his return to Innsmouth. And so saying, he conducted him post-haste to the rear entrance. Hardly had the door closed behind the sailor before Dr. Shrewsbury was back. "Mr. Phelan, in a few moments a gentleman will call and ask for Fernandez. When the knocker sounds, answer the knock. Tell him you have not seen Fernandez. You do not know who he is. You know no one of that name." I had no time to take issue with such orders. In any case, it was not my place to do so. I yielded to Dr. Shrewsbury's outstretched hand and placed my transcription in it, even as the knocker sound echoed through the house. My employer nodded curtly. I went to the door and opened it. Never have I felt such extreme and immediate revulsion as I did at the sight of the man on the stoop. There was admittedly no street light for some distance, and the light which flowed from the hall was so dim as to be more confusing than helpful, but I am prepared to swear that not only was there a grotesquely frog-like aspect about the fellow's face, irrationally and yet perhaps not inappropriately, there flashed into mine at once the oddly fascinating depiction by Tenniel of the frog footman of the Duchess and Alice in Wonderland, but that his fingers, where one hand rested upon the iron rail of the stoop, were webbed. Moreover, he exuded an almost overpowering odor of the sea, not that smell so commonly associated with coastal areas, but of watery depths. One might have thought that from this oddly wide mouth there would issue sounds as repulsive as his aspect, but on the contrary, he spoke in flawless English, and inquired with almost exaggerated politeness whether a friend of his, one Señor de Molto Fernandez, had called here. "I have no acquaintance with Señor Fernandez," I answered. He stood there for a moment, giving me a contemplative stare which, had I been prey to imaginative fear, would most certainly have chilled me. Then he nodded, thanked me, bade me good night, and turned to walk away into the foggy darkness. I returned to the professor's study. Without looking up from the transcription he held in his hand, Dr. Shrewsbury asked me to describe our inquiring caller. I did so, omitting no detail of his attire, as I had seen it in the uncertain light, and not forgetting to mention also my curious revulsion at sight of him. He nodded, smiling grimly. "They are everywhere, those creatures," he said cryptically, but he offered no explanation of the singular incident. Instead, he went on to suggest a reason for his interest in the account of the sailor Fernandez. "No doubt it occasioned some question in my mind," he said, "in regard to his patient delving, but it had long ago seemed apparent that there might well be a connection between certain forms of worship in the great plateaus of unknown Central Asia, notably that of Leng, a hidden and secret place, and that of older and more primitive cultures on other continents, some of which doubtless survived in various forms to this day. Kimmich, for instance, asks where the Chimu civilization of Khmer came from, if not remote places within what is now China. And the Dravidians, who were driven out of parts of India by Aryans and went to Malaysia and Polynesia, later to mix with these same whites and move eastward as far as an Easter Island and Peru, must have brought with them certain strange rites and worship patterns. In short, it has come to me increasingly that there is a fundamental relationship among many ancient cultures and religious beliefs of which we have only a fragmentary knowledge. At the moment, my concern is a possible dual role of the war god of the Kisha Ayars, the devourer, and the survival of a monstrous pre-human time, the water being Cthulhu, worship of whom seems to have forbidding roots even into the present, so strongly embedded indeed among certain sects little known to man, that there is a profoundly intense and consciously malignant determination to keep from the rest of the world any knowledge which might lead to exposure before the time which these devotees of strange cults consider propitious for the coming again of Cthulhu. He talked in this vein for some time, and most of what he said was beyond me, as perhaps he suspected it might be, though he did not elaborate. However, it was patent to me that his concern for the sailor Fernandez was occasioned by his knowledge of the habits of the cultists, of whom, presumably, though Dr. Shrewsbury did not say so, our second caller had been one. Nevertheless, for all his vagueness and the generalities of his monologue, I could not help being conscious of a concept that embodied not only a paralyzing vastness, since the worship of prehuman eras was involved, but also a numbing fright in the incredible horrors and demonic myth patterns it suggested. That the professor feared for the life of the sailor Fernandez seemed obvious, though he never said as much directly. Yet, he told of the London scholar Follexen, who was drowned inexplicably in the Thames off Limehouse shortly after he had announced himself as on the trail of important disclosures relative to certain ancient survivals in the East Indies, of the presumably accidental death of the archaeologist Sir Cheever Vordens after the discovery of certain black monoliths in Western Australia, of the curious illness which removed from the terrestrial scene after the publication of tales purporting to be fiction, and revealing progressively more and more about the Cthulhu Nyarlathotep great old ones cults, particularly the hellishly revelatory novel At the Mountains of Madness, hinting at strange, terrible survivals in the Arctic wastes, that great modern master of the macabre, H.P. Lovecraft. But there was one aspect of that singular evening about which Dr. Shrewsbury said nothing, ignoring it as if it did not exist, nor did I myself think of it until after I had made 3 copies of the transcribed conversation at the professor's direction, and had retired to my room. When it came to me, while I lay turning over in my mind the strange events into which I had so blindly plunged, I had had evidence of a certain power possessed by my employer almost at once, and had not recognized it before I had knocked. He had opened the door to me, and again he had somehow seemed to sense the approach of Fernandez. But even more startling was his curious, inexplicable divination of the approach of the caller who came to inquire about the sailor. How had he become aware of him? Perhaps he had developed a supersensory ability which enabled him to hear sounds such as footsteps beyond the ken of the average mortal. But even so, even if he had heard the footsteps of the oncoming pursuer, how could he have known his purpose? Deeply perplexed, I pondered this puzzle late into the night, only to fall asleep at last with no intimation of its solution, and hazily aware of the incredibly ancient atmosphere of the house in which I had now taken up my abode, an atmosphere that burgeoned with mystery and age, and inescapably an aura of dread. Undoubtedly, the first of those strange dreams in the house on Kerwin Street was the result of what my employer found in the papers he sent me out to get late in the following day, after I had spent hours with him, assimilating materials he had previously gathered from all corners of the earth. He had told me that he was very seldom left the house, that indeed most of the residents of Arkham were not even aware of his existence, and he said that I would frequently be required to run such little errands for him. Ordinarily, he took no paper save the New York Times, the mere affairs of the mundane world, even the shaping of events towards another catastrophical war in Europe, were of no moment to him. But on this day he sought a particular piece of information, which he was certain might be found in the pages of the Innsmouth Courier or the Newburyport Correspondent, if not in the local papers. But it was from the Innsmouth paper that he finally clipped a brief, pointed little article and handed it to me with instructions to file it together with my transcription of the previous night's conversation. The article, which was suggestive and frightening in the light of what the professor had hinted in his final monologue the night before, read: "The body of a sailor who fell to his death from the docks, ruined by federal agents in the winter of 1928, was recovered this noon in the vicinity of Devil Reef. A native reported the accident early this morning, saying that the sailor seemed to be walking in the company of, or just ahead of, a companion who had disappeared. However, when the local residents reached the spot, stories of a struggle in the water and certain references to webbed hands are generally considered the product of a bottle. The sailor was identified as one Dimoto Fernandez, late of the Chan Chang out of Trujillo." The implications of this casual article were ominous. Yet there was no word from the professor. Clearly he had expected something of the kind. His interest in it did not smack of regret, but only of a kind of casual philosophic acceptance. He added no comment whatever to it, and his entire attitude forbade any inquiry from me. Yet it had an ultimate effect on him, for after an hour's study of the conversation transcript, he found among his papers a detailed map of Peru, and before this he sat for another hour, carefully scrutinizing the Andean country in the region of the ruins of Machu Picchu, Cusco, the Salapunco fortress, and the Cordillera de Villagnota, finally marking off a small area between the fortress and the site of Machu Picchu. Doubtless, it was my observation of this singularly intent and soundless study which was in part responsible for the extraordinary dream of that night, the first of that astonishing sequence, for immediately following his examination of the map, my employer betrayed an odd eccentricity and decreed that we should both retire, though the night was still very young. Indeed, dusk had hardly given way to darkness, and from outside still came the muted crying of birds subsiding for the night. Moreover, before I slept, I must partake of a venerable old mead which he himself had brewed, a wonderfully golden liquid which he kept in a carafe in his desk and served in tiny Belgian liqueur glasses, in such small amounts that it seemed futile even to raise it to one's lips. And yet its bouquet and its taste were such as to amply repay any effort made to obtain it. For it outdid even the oldest Chianti and the best Chateau Quem to such an extent that to mention them in the same breath was to do injustice to the professor's brew. Fiery though it was, it had the additional effect of making me drowsy, with the result that I no longer felt any reluctance to retire to my room, and accordingly bade the professor good night and went up the stairs. I must have thrown myself upon my bed fully dressed, for that is how I awakened in the morning. However, between darkness and daylight, the extraordinary vividness of the dream that took possession of me was so compelling that when much later I feared for my sanity and consulted a psychiatrist in regard to the succession of dreams which this inaugurated, I was able to relate it in the smallest detail, even if it had not been for those shocking and hideously suggestive discoveries I made later. The data taken down and summarized by Dr. Asenath Devoto tells as succinctly as possible the essential substance of the dream, and I cannot do better than to copy it into my narrative just as he took it down. Case history: Andrew Phelan, age 28, of white parents, born in Roxbury, Massachusetts. Dream 1. Professor Shrewsbury came to my room, carrying my transcription pad and several pencils. He woke me, gave me what he carried, and said, "Come." Then he stepped to the lighted window opening from my room to the south, opened it, and looked out. The night was very black. He turned to me and said, "Just wait a minute," as if we were going somewhere. Then he took from his pocket a curiously shaped whistle, which he blew upon. After he had made its strange undulant sound, he shouted into space. He said, "Hastur, Hastur." Then he took me by the hand and stepped up to the sill of the tall, narrow window. I followed him, and both of us stepped out into space. I felt something beneath us, and I saw that each of us was riding a monstrous black-winged bat-like creature, which traveled with the speed of light. In a very little while we were set down in a country of great mountains. I thought at first it was uninhabited country, but presently it was clear to me that we were in a remote, almost inaccessible region which had been the seat of an ancient civilization, for we were in the vicinity of a building of great granite blocks, trapezoid in shape, with monolithic columns. This rose behind a high rampart, more than twice as tall as we were, but it was not here we were apparently destined to go, for Dr. Shrewsbury turned and led the way down an old road, past many long abandoned structures, which appeared to be portions of pre-legendary megalithic buildings, deeper and deeper into the gorges and passes of the valleys, lying among the mountains, ultimately leaving the road and exploring clefts and passages in the rocky cliffs and other areas that jutted forth. We seemed to progress with great speed, and it did not seem that either time or space could hinder us. Indeed, there was no time. I was not aware of time passing or of any other physical need. Though it was night and the stars were in their place, the Southern Cross, Great Canopus, and other I recognized. Dr. Shrewsbury seemed to know where he was going, for presently he arrived at the place he sought, and I saw him press his hands and fingers upon a great stone wall, walking along in a place only a little above a torrential river which flowed past beneath in the depths of the gorge. Suddenly, a portion of the stone wall tipped open and we entered. The place into which we walked was a short, narrow passageway, sloping sharply down. Dr. Shrewsbury led the way and I followed. We seemed to float along. The corridor presently opened upon a vast subterranean cavern filled with a kind of green light, subaqueous and unnatural, which seemed to emanate from a body of water not far away. It was the place described by the sailor Fernandez. Dr. Shrewsbury went directly to the water's edge, touched it with a finger, and tasted it, seeing which I was impelled to do likewise, despite the greenish-black muck of the earth at the water's edge. Though there was little soil there, only a thin, siltish covering over rock. The water was salty. "As I thought," said Dr. Shrewsbury, "the lake has subterranean canals leading to the Pacific, as such passages would be certain to give into the Humboldt currents." He ordered me to transcribe this fact, and I did so, adding at his direction a detailed description of the cavern, or as much of it as I could see in the pallid light. This is a second occurrence of the Humboldt currents in such a connection, and it is therefore not too much to suppose that at some point in their course the currents touch upon sunken Rialye. He went on talking to himself, yet indicating that I was to put down everything he conjectured. While I was thus engaged, a native of Indian stock appeared. Seeing him emerge from the farther wall, Dr. Shrewsbury immediately advanced upon him and spoke to him in Spanish, to which the Indian shook his head and threatened my employer with a small club he carried. But the professor took from another pocket a strange five-pointed star-shaped stone and held this up before the Indian. This conveyed something to him which made him less suspicious of us and more amenable. The professor then spoke in another language, which I could not understand, and finally in a third, which had a horrible sound, akin to the sounds the professor had made before stepping out into space from the windowsill. As he spoke this language, which the Indian understood and evidently respected, my employer translated, and I took down questions and answers in our own language. "Where is the door to Cthulhu?" The Indian pointed at the lake. "There is the door, but it is not the time." "This is but one of many doors," the professor went on. "Do you know another?" "No, this is the one. This is his portal." "How many are there of us in this place?" By thus misrepresenting ourselves as fellow cultists, the professor induced the Indian to reveal that there were less than 200 of the worshippers of Cthulhu in the Cordillera de Villagnota. At this moment, a faint disturbance in the water of the subterranean lake became noticeable, and instantly the professor's demeanor underwent a significant change. He stood for a moment watching the trembling and shuddering of the water, and waited until it began to boil up and churn before he turned once more to the engine and asked rapidly when the time of the next meeting would be. "Tomorrow night. You are a day too soon." Then Dr. Shrewsbury led the way out of the cavern, turning at the threshold to look back. I did likewise. I saw a horrible thing. I cannot describe it. It was a vast protoplasmic mass, which underwent many mutations when it rose out of the water, in all its monstrous horror. For it seemed to come a combination of strange, unearthly music and a shrill, urgent whistling. Then the professor tugged at my sleeve and we went outside of the cavern, where at once Dr. Shrewsbury summoned the strange, bat-like creatures which had brought us, and we returned as we had come to the house on Kerwin Street. Manifestly, it was not strange that I should have dreamed of the oddly suggestive narrative of the sailor Fernandez, but there were certain disquieting features of that dream which upset me, and there was an astonishingly realistic and curiously detailed background for that dream. It would be untrue if I said that it did not trouble me. Moreover, there were certain puzzling conditions under which it had taken place. For one thing, the intoxicating effect of Dr. Shrewsbury's mead, causing me to go to sleep immediately. For another, the absolute lack of memory of whether or not I had removed my shoes before throwing myself on the bed. For in the morning, when I woke to bright sunlight streaming into the room, my shoes were gone, and I was forced to wear my bedroom slippers. The professor explained that he had sent my shoes out to be cleaned, and while I laid this to his eccentricity, yet it seemed exceedingly strange to me that he should have taken the trouble to remove them while I slept. For the first half of that day he discoursed upon the languages of those obscure evil cults, the prehuman language of Nakal, Aklo, and Sothyo, and from the dread Necronomicon of the mad Arab Abdul Azared. Dr. Shrewsbury quoted the translation of a couplet which, in the light of subsequent events, assumed a terrible significance. That is not dead which can eternal lie, and with strange eons even death may die. But it was in the real Yin language that he was not most interested in. There were certain hints in the less obscure passages of the Necronomicon, as well as in the shuddersome real Ye text, which seemed to indicate that the waited time for the resurgence of Cthulhu was growing near, and there were, moreover, certain disturbing anagrammatic cross-references in the later oblique Latin prophecies of Nostradamus, which told of catastrophic events to come, and there was the additional incidence of evidence in notes the professor had earlier taken and which I had to transcribe, which indicated that there had been, within the past decade, a startling and ominous revival of ancient cults all over the world. More than ever, I was aware of the undeniable fact that, however frank and engaging my employer seemed to be in his discussion of his interests, he took great pains, even without seeming to do so, to prevent me from learning too much. In short, no matter what he said, he spoke either in terms so vague as to be virtually meaningless, without the proper information or background, or with such lofty and erudite references that it was frankly impossible to patch together anything even remotely resembling a coherent narrative. At the end of that day, I knew no more than I had known after my first conversation with the professor, that he was on the track of certain blasphemous cults of ancient, pre-human eras, whose survival to the present day in out-of-the-way places seemed to fascinate him. The references he made to colossal beings, the great old ones, quotations from such books as the Comte Erlet's Culte de Gouz, the Panotic manuscripts, the Libor Ivoni, and the Auspolecan Colton of Van Junst, oblique mention of such beings as Nyarlathotep, Hastur, Loigor, Cthulhu, Azathoth, which, in addition to Cthulhu, had their own bodies of worshippers. All these were impossible of any coherence. Nor was it possible for me to make anything out of the quotations from the ancient books which the professor put me to transcribing in triplicate, though they were filled with the most outré and terrifying implications, and some among them were fixed in my memory, even as I became aware of what it was I put down. Ubal Sathla is the source, the unbegotten beginning from whom came those who dared set themselves against the elder gods who ruled from Betelgeuse, those who warred upon the elder gods, the great old ones led by the blind idiot god Azeroth and Yog-Sothoth, who is all in one and one in all, and upon whom are no strictures of time or space, and whose ancients are Umar At-Tawil, and the ancient ones who dream forever of that time when once again they shall rule, to whom rightfully belong earth and the entire universe of which it is a part. Great Cthulhu shall rise from Ra'al-Ye. Hastur the Unspeakable shall return from the dark star which is in the Hades near Aldebaran, the red eye of the bull. Nyarlathotep shall howl forever in the darkness where he abideth. Shub-Niggurath shall spawn his thousand young, and they shall spawn in turn, and shall take dominion over all wood nymphs, satyrs, leprechauns, and the little people. Lord Igor, Tsar, and Ithaqua shall ride the spaces among the stars, and those who serve them, the Chocho, shall be ennobled. Kathuga shall encompass his dominion from Fromohat, and Tsagwa shall come from the Kai. They wait by the gates, for the time draws near, the hour soon at hand, and the elder gods sleep, dreaming, and there are those who know the spells put upon the great old ones by the elder gods, as there are those who shall learn how to break them, as already they know how to command the servants of those who wait beyond the door from outside. In the course of that day, the professor descended to a laboratory on the lowest floor of the building and busied himself with what appeared to be chemical experiments, leaving me to my own devices upstairs, though in mid-afternoon he came up, carrying my shoes, now cleaned and polished, and instructed me to go to the library of Miskatonic University and transcribe page 177 of the Necronomicon. I was glad to leave the house, even for what promised to be so brief a task, and I took my departure at once. The indicated page was in the Latin of Aulus Wormius, and was equally as meaningless as earlier references. Though truth to tell, there was now beginning to form in my mind certain dark suspicions which I did not dare fully face, preferring rather to remain completely objective in my approach, as Dr. Shrewsbury had suggested would be the best course for me to follow. The page in question was not long, and it was apparently being copied because of some doubt held by my employer about his own previous copy, which I had had opportunity to see earlier that day. For within the five-pointed star caravan of gray stone from ancient Menar lies armor against witches and demons, against the deep ones, the Doles, the Vormis, the Chocho, the abominable Migo, the Shoggoths, the Volutians, and all such peoples and beings who serve the great old ones and their spawn. But it is less potent against the great old ones themselves. He who hath the five-pointed stone shall find himself able to command all beings who creep, swim, crawl, walk, or fly even to the source from which there is no returning. In the land of Yi, as in great Ryle Ye, in Yana Letai as in Yoth, in Yugoth as in Sothik, in the Kai as in Kanyan, in Kadath in the cold waste as in the lake of Hali, in Carcosa as in Ebe, it shall have power, but even as the stars wane and grow cold, as the suns die, and the spaces between the stars grow more great, so wanes the power of all things, of the five-pointed star stone, as of the spells put upon the great old ones by the benign elder gods. And there shall come a time, as once there was a time, and it shall be shown that is not dead which can eternal lie, and with strange eons even death may die. While I was engaged in copying this page, I observed that I was being kept under eye by an aged attendant who contrived to move ever closer to me. Since the Necronomicon was so rare a book, but five copies were known to be in existence, I naturally assumed that the old gentleman was intent upon seeing that no harm come to it. But presently it occurred to me that his interest was rather in me than in the book, and having finished, I leaned back and afforded him an opportunity to speak to me if he desired to do so. He took the opportunity with alacrity, and introduced himself as an old resident of Arkham. Was I not the young man who worked for Professor Shrewsbury? I admitted that I was. His eyes shone extraordinarily, and his fingers began to tremble. Clearly, he said, I was not a native, for there were curious stories about the professor. Where was he those 20 years? Asked Mr. Peabody. Did he ever say to you? I was mystified. What 20 years? Ah, you don't even know, huh? Well, I don't wonder he won't say anything. But he was gone, slick and clean as a whistle. Just vanished into the wind, you might say, for 20 years. 3 years ago, he came back. Didn't look a day older, and just went on as if nothing had happened. Traveling, he says he was. But it looks mighty queer that a man could disappear from the middle of the street, you might say, and be gone for 20 years, never draw a penny of his money from the bank, and then come back and take up just where he left off, as if nothing at all had taken place. Not a day older, not a whit different. No, sir, that's not natural. If he was traveling, what did he use for money? I worked in the bank that time, I know. This came out in such a spate of words that it took me a few moments to assimilate. It was not strange that Professor Shrewsbury should be the object of almost superstitious suspicion among the natives. Ancient Arkham, with its gambrel roofs and forbidding dormers, with its legends of witches and exorcised devils, and was indeed a likely and fertile ground for the growth of doubt and distrust, particularly when such reactions concerned someone who was so manifestly versed in fabled lore as Dr. Shrewsbury. "He has never mentioned it to me," I said, with as much dignity as I could muster. "No, and he won't. And don't you mention this to him either. It might be as much as my job's worth, though I don't know that he ever did anything to anybody. Just always living so much alone and keeping to himself like he does." I did not think it fitting to discuss my employer in this fashion. So politely but firmly I pointed out that there was doubtless entirely logical explanations for what had taken place, ignored his quick retort. "They've all been gone into, and not a one fits," and took my departure. However, I did not immediately leave the building. Impelled by curiosity stimulated by Mr. Peabody's inquiry, I sought the newspaper files of both the Arkham Papers, the Gazette, and the Advertiser. I had no difficulty confirming Mr. Peabody's curious story. Professor Shrewsbury had literally disappeared from a country lane west of Arkham, where he had been seen walking but a few moments before, one evening in September, 23 years ago. No clue had ever been discovered, not in the lane or in his house. His house had been shut up pending the appearance of a claimant, and since none had ever come forward and the property taxes had been duly paid by Dr. Shrewsbury's legal adviser, it had remained in this state until suddenly one day 3 years ago. Dr. Shrewsbury walked out of it, looking fit as a fiddle, as close-mouthed as a clam about his whereabouts, and resumed his regular way of life, save only that his researches now took a somewhat different line, and his daily existence followed a slightly different pattern. The newspapers had treated the story seriously enough, but had obviously yielded to Dr. Shrewsbury's insistence to close the incident as quickly and quietly as possible, for there was a cessation of all accounts and speculations, which was as sudden as the incident's beginning. As curiously as this strange occurrence affected me, yet I could not but feel that it was my employer's privilege to maintain such silence as he thought best to keep. I could not, however, deny to myself that the discovery of this curious fact affected me strangely, perhaps not unpleasantly, and yet not entirely agreeably. It was patent that the situation which I found myself was bewildering to the extreme. Dr. Shrewsbury's apparently had more than one kind of reputation, and though no one had ever taken occasion to say anything derogatory about him to me, I could sense an undercurrent of distrust and suspicion of him. When I reached the house on Kerwin Street, I found the professor once again in his study, carefully handling a package which he was arranging on his desk at the moment of my entrance. As I came into the room, he extended a careless hand for the transcript, and almost at the same instant gave me a list of materials he needed, instructing me to obtain them on the next occasion I had to go into the shopping district of Arkham. I glanced at the list of materials and was astonished to discover that all were well-known chemical ingredients for the making of nitroglycerin. This, together with the care with which my employer handled the package on his desk, seemed to indicate an even greater scope of interest than I had at first given the professor credit for. "Yes, this is what I wanted. I did have it right," mused the professor, reading my transcript carefully and repeating some parts of it aloud, though the effect of his doing so with the black glasses masking his eyes was oddly unnerving. But in a moment he put it down. "Now, then, I'll go to bed early tonight. If you like, you can work here. You have enough to do. Or you may go to bed, too. Or if you should want to go out." "No, I've no wish to go out. In no circumstances am I to be disturbed until morning." It was late twilight when we sat down to a frugal meal, and immediately thereafter the professor repaired to his room, taking with him not only the package from his desk, but also the decanter of his golden mead and a glass. I thought it oddly discourteous of him not to offer me another taste of his agreeable liquor, but forbore to say so. But I had little time in which to think of this, for work beckoned me to the study, and there I spent the first half of the night. It must have been close to midnight when I was aware of the rising storm outside and heard the banging of a shutter. I had noticed a cumulus cloud bank lounging on the horizon when I returned from the library of Miskatonic University. Doubtless it was these clouds which had moved across the face of heaven and were now responsible for both wind and rain. The banging shutter, however, beat insistently on my consciousness, and finally I got up to investigate it. It was, in any case, time for me to retire. I made the rounds of ground floor, but there both windows and shutters were shut or fixed firmly down. It must then be on the second floor, and accordingly I went up the stairs, first to my own room and then to the others, only to reach the conclusion that the shutter was banging as one of the windows in Professor Shrewsbury's bedroom. I hesitated to go in and fix it, but reflected that my doing so would in all probability prevent its waking him. So I turned the knob of his door silently and entered his room, leaving the door slightly ajar, for I did not want to turn on the light. I found my way to the window, which was standing open so that the wind could blow the rain into the room. I leaned out, adjusted the shutter, and drew back, in lowering the window somewhat, but not entirely closing it. As I turned, my eyes fell across the bed, and I saw that my employer was not in it. I crossed the room and opened the door wider, mystified. The light from the hall streamed in to reveal that he had apparently only lain down on the bed. He had not undressed. For some reason unknown to me, he had gone out. But I had no sooner come to this conclusion before I was uncomfortably aware that I had heard no sound where I worked in the library. And it seemed a manifest impossibility that the old man should have been able to leave the house without somehow attracting my attention. While I was pondering this, I saw the decanter of mead and the glass Dr. Shrewsbury had taken with him to his room. I crossed over to it, and examining the glass, saw that my employer had drunk of it. Indeed, there was still a drop or so in the slim glass, and impulsively I lifted it to my lips and allowed the fiery liquid to roll over my tongue and down my throat. Then I left the room, resolutely determined to make no inquiry as to Dr. Shrewsbury's whereabouts, since I had no right to pry into matters that did not concern me. But my curiosity in regard to my employer's strange absence soon gave way before another even stranger occurrence. I have hinted previously that there was about the old house on Kerwin Street an aura almost as of dread. I had hardly got into bed before I was acutely aware of this, even to the extent of imagining inimical hosts pressing upon the building from all sides, but particularly from the side of the house which faced the fog-bound Miskatonic River. Moreover, I was only briefly conscious of this peculiar phenomenon before I was even more sharply aware of something more, something even stranger. This was nothing less than an auditory illusion, and that I heard, or seemed to hear, strange sounds which could not possibly have had an origin anywhere but within my subconscious, for there was no other rational explanation of the noises I now heard on the borderland of sleep. They began with the sound of footsteps, not steps along the walk outside of the house, nor along the floor or even the ground beneath my window, but steps that scraped and stumbled along what must certainly have been a rocky or stony path, for there was occasionally also the additional small noises of stones or rock fragments rolling and falling, and once or twice the distinct impression as of something striking water. How long these sounds lasted, I have no way of knowing. Indeed, I grew so accustomed to them, despite their strangeness, that I lay in a condition of semi-sleep, until I was brought bolt upright in bed by a thunderstorm detonation, followed by other explosive sounds, and the terrible urgency of crashing rocks and shale, succeeded by a bitter cry, "Too little! Too little!" Now there was no possibility of hallucination, save that arising from delirium. I was reasonably certain that I was not delirious. In fact, I got out of bed, went to the bathroom, and got myself a glass of water. I returned to my bed once more, composed myself again for sleep, and distinctly heard a whistled undulation followed by a chanting voice, saying those same mystic words of my first strange dream in the house. "Hastur! Hastur!" Then there was a great rushing sound, as of colossal wings, and then silence, complete and absolute, and no further sound impinging upon my consciousness save the normal sounds of the night and Arkham. To say that I was disturbed is to diminish my reaction to insignificance. I was profoundly troubled, but even in my unnatural drowsiness, I could not help reflecting that on the first occasion of drinking Dr. Shrewsbury's mead, I had had so strange and vivid a dream, and now, with just a drop or two of it, I had somehow had my sensory perception heightened beyond every natural plane. This explanation occurred to me at first with the utmost conviction, but as I contemplated it, I found myself forced to reject it as scientifically unsound. How close I came at that moment to the incredible truth I did not learn for some weeks, for at the time I was aware only of the one property I knew the mead to possess, that of making me extremely sleepy, and I drowsed off. In the morning I debated telling the professor of my experience, but ultimately I resolved to say nothing. His insistence on my lack of imagination at our first interview led me to believe that he might go so far as to terminate my employment if he heard such an account from my lips. For the same reason, I had told him nothing of my odd dream. Nor did the professor offer any explanation of his unaccountable absence of the previous night. I had been briefly apprehensive lest he still be absent. I knew that the questions he had originally asked me about my ability to defend myself in a physical sense pertained to a possibility that I might have to act as his bodyguard whenever he went out. But he had now returned. He was deep in his studies when I entered the library, to find him sitting before a large-scale map pinned up across the bookshelves, a map of all the earth upon which he had placed little red-headed pins here and there. Indeed, at the moment he had just identified a place in South America, when he turned to greet me, quite cheerfully, despite a rather haggard look. After breakfast, we plunged immediately into the correlation of earlier notes and references made by the professor, as usual, about certain cults, curious present-day resurrivals of strange worship, and the like, and I observed that same care and reticence about my employer which I had so readily noticed from the beginning. Our work was leisurely, if obscure to me. There was no sense of pressure at any time, and I found myself growing very interested in the strange beings which, according to my employer, had been worshipped terrestrially and interplanetarily by pre-human races of creatures. As day followed day, these shadowy great beings and their followers began to take on a subconscious existence just across the borderland from reality, a tenuous, fantastic shaping up in my imagination, though not without certain dark hints of terror and awful dread, which came upon me from time to time. On the third day of this work, the professor provided a startling little epilogue to the curious incident of the sailor Fernandez and his story. He was at the moment reading in the New York Times, when I saw a smile briefly touch his lips. He reached for scissors and clipped an item, which he handed to me, saying that I might add it to the file on Fernandez, and marked the file closed. The item was of wire service origin, datelined from Lima, Peru, and read: a localized earth shock in the Cordillera de Vicanota last night completely destroyed a rocky hill along the river between the deserted Inca city of Machu Picchu and the fortress of Salapunco. Señorita Isola Montes, instructor at the Indian school, which is kept in one room of the abandoned fortress, reported that the shock came with the force of an explosion, threw her out of bed, and aroused the Indians for many miles around. Despite the evidence of the shattered hill, which apparently collapsed into an underground river or reservoir, doubtless stemming from the gorge, seismographs at Lima recorded no disturbance of the earth in the vicinity. Scientists are inclined to regard the incident as evidence only of a local collapse brought about by a weakening of the cavernous understructure of the hill below Salapunco. A number of Indians of the vicinity whose presence at the scene has been unaccounted for were killed. It was again a newspaper account which was responsible for the second and also subsequently for the last of those strange dreams I had in the house on Kerwin Street. So long a time had passed since the previous dream, almost 2 months, for it was now mid-August, that I had come to look upon the initial sleep-bound adventure as a remarkable effect of the house itself, the possible result of a change in my way of existence when I removed from Boston. Moreover, within the fortnight immediately past, Dr. Shrewsbury had begun the dictation of a second book, designed to follow an investigation into the myth patterns of latter-day primitives, with a special reference to the Relier text. He had entitled his second book, Cthulhu and the Necronomicon, and for the most part it was utterly incomprehensible to me, being a book written for savants by a savant. But from time to time there occurred strangely stirring passages, which now and then seemed to touch upon my own boundaries of recent experience in a disturbing fashion. He was dictating such paragraphs on the morning of the day which was to end with a second of those remarkable dreams. It never seems to occur to the man of even superior intelligence that these incredible myth patterns have their survival in the present day, and yet it should not seem at all impossible, for it is manifest that their beliefs are centered upon beings which are for the most part coexistent with all time and conterminous with space. Moreover, their extra-dimensional properties allow for much greater latitude than the dimensional laws of our own sciences. By denying this, by implication, they deny also that it might be possible to systematically hunt down and close the openings from that borderland, for it had been shown in repeated instances that the great old ones cannot come forth unless they are summoned by those minions who are ever ready to serve them here and on other stars and planets. I refer the skeptical to the occurrence at Devil Reef off Innsmouth, and direct your attention to those curiously frog-like survivals one may yet find in isolated places in the vicinity of both Innsmouth and Newburyport, as well as to the thinly disguised fiction of it by the late H.P. Lovecraft. I commend him likewise to the study of certain parallelisms, a comparison between Ithaqua, the windwalker of the ancient myth patterns, and the Wendigo of the Northwood Indians, between the Devourer, the war god of the Quechua Ayars, and Cthulhu of the Mythos, to mention but two which occur to me and to which I have given some little thought. The similarities are almost instantly apparent. By this persistent denial of certain evidential aspects which are beyond scientific explanation as we now define science. The doubters make it impossible, or well nigh impossible, to utilize the known enmities along the lesser beings, who would ultimately once again assume sway over the destiny of the planets, and who are unified only in their incessant war upon the impregnable elder gods, who must ultimately awake and renew the spells which bind this evil spawn, and which are now weakening as the eons pass since their initial imprisonment. They would thus thrust aside the possibility of increasing the tension between such followers of Cthulhu as those frog-like deep ones who inhabit the many-columned city of Yahanathaleh, deep in the Atlantic, off the blasted port of Innsmouth, as well as sunken Rilye, and the bat-winged interplanetary travelers who are half-man, half-beast, and serve Cthulhu's half-brother, him who is not to be named, Hastur the Unspeakable, of setting against one another the amorphous spawn who serve the mad faceless Nyla Hotep and the black goat of the woods, Shub-Niggurath, and the flame creatures of Cthuga, among whom they exist eternal rivalry, which might well be turned into devastating fury. Let the servants be in turn summoned to the aid of some enlightened brain, so that the openings for Cthulhu may be stopped by the aid of those air beings serving Hastur in your Igor. Let the minions of Cthuga destroy the hidden places within the earth where Nyla Hotep and Shub-Niggurath and their hideous offspring dwell. Knowledge is power, but knowledge is also madness, and it is not for the weak to take arms against these hellish beings. As Lovecraft wrote, man must be prepared to accept notions of the cosmos and of his own place in the seething vortex of time, whose merest mention is paralyzing. At this point, Dr. Shrewsbury had completed the first volume of his second book, a book never destined to be finished, though I did not know it then. And he directed me thereupon to complete my transcription in triplicate, proof and ship the remaining manuscript to the printer, together with a check to cover the cost of production, for no publisher would risk money by bringing out such a book as this, which, though it purported to be factual, had every aspect of the wildest, most incredible fiction, besides which the highly colored romances of Jules Verne and H.G. Wells paled into utter insignificance, for the professor swung boldly away from the terrestrial scene with such conviction that it was impossible to read what he had written without a kind of paralyzing apprehension and an increased awareness of forces and powers beyond the comprehension of men. As I turned to the transcription, my employer took up that day's paper, glancing rapidly down each column and going from page to page. He had got perhaps to the sixth or seventh page when he gave an exclamation half of delight, half of alarm, and reached for the scissors to clip a brief article, which he handed to me with instructions to begin a new file. I put it to one side, and only when I had completed my work on the first portion of Cthulhu and the Necronomicon did I turn to it again. That was in late afternoon, and by that time I had observed in my employer a steadily increasing excitement, as if he were laboring under some inner pressure and could not wait for the time appointed for its relief. The article was brief and couched in the usual dignified language of the times. London, August 17. A mystery that might have come from the pages of one of Charles Fort's remarkable books is suggested by the case of Nayland Macy, a dock worker who has been absent from his home for 7 months. Mr. Macy turned up the other day. He was found wandering on the streets and identified by marks he carried. He could not speak a word of English, but speaks a strange, foreign tongue, which no one has yet been able to identify. His condition is serious. The eminent specialist on unusual diseases, Sir Lendon Petre, who is an accomplished linguist, has been called into consultation. There is no clue whatever to the place where Mr. Macy might have spent the 7 months of his strange absence. It was an account, in short, of which there was many similar narratives in the files I had taken opportunity to glance over from time to time at Dr. Shrewsbury's direction, and it seemed incredible that it could stimulate the two dreams which were to come. For that night came the second of that unbelievable trio of dreams, and it was presaged by precisely the same events as the first, by Dr. Shrewsbury's insistence upon our early retirement in order to be ready for more intense work tomorrow, by a drink of his golden mead, and by the quick drowsiness and the dream-haunted sleep that followed. I turn again to the account given to Dr. Devoto and transcribed by him under the heading of Dream 2. Professor Shrewsbury came to my room as before, once again carrying a pad and pencils, which he gave to me after he had awakened me. Everything happened as before. After he had opened the windows and shouted that strange command into space, we stepped out and found ourselves once more astride the huge bat-winged creatures of the first dream. I remember making an examination of them, but apart from the curiously repellent feeling as of human flesh under my hands and furred wings, I was not able to ascertain what these creatures were like, but it now seemed to me that Professor Shrewsbury talked to them. Again, in a short while, we were put down, but this time it was soon apparent that we were in no isolated locality, for lights glowed all around us, and off to our left there were great beacons and a floodlit field. Dr. Shrewsbury seemed to know precisely where we were, and he made for the buildings beyond the floodlit field with as much haste as he could muster. We were not far away, and it was soon evident that we were following a country lane. As we drew near to the floodlit area of the buildings, I began to be aware of a vague familiarity, as if I had been in this place before, not too long ago. Presently, I recognized the surroundings. We were at Croydon Aerodrome, which I had visited 3 years before as an undergraduate. The professor's purpose was soon clear. He had gone there only to get a taxicab, into which he bundled me, and then sought a city directory inside the nearest building. When he came out, he directed the driver to take us to an address in Park Lane, and to wait there for us. We were taken to the Park Lane address, and applied for admittance, which we did not gain until my employer took out his card and wrote across it, in regard to the case of Nayland Macy. After this had been taken in, we were permitted to enter, and we were conducted into the presence of an elderly and very dignified man, whom Professor Shrewsbury addressed as Dr. Petra. My employer immediately indicated his interest in the case of the dock worker Macy, and explained that he had come by air from his home in America to determine whether he might not be able to identify and translate the language which the mysteriously absent dock worker now spoke. Dr. Petra was immediately most helpful. He explained that Macy had been only an illiterate fellow, but that in this language, which he now spoke, together with a mixture of occasional Greek and Latin words, he betrayed a high degree of intelligence. In short, though the physical man who had returned from whatever place he had been was the same, the mental man was obviously not similar. Moreover, his physical condition was such that he was not expected to live long, for he had apparently been exposed to rigorous climates and conditioned to violent climatic changes, but that conditioning was rapidly wearing off, and he would not be able to withstand the damage done to his body in that change. Today's London Times had a rather complete summary of the case, if Dr. Shrewsbury would care to have Dr. Petra's copy. My employer accepted the paper and gave it to me. I put it into my pocket. My employer then suggested that he would like to interview the patient, if possible. Sir Lendon Petra ordered his own car out and accompanied us across London to the East India Dock Road, where the dock worker Macy was being kept, in a kind of coma, but able at times to answer certain questions put to him in Latin and Greek. We were admitted by his nurse, and taken at once to the bedside. There lay a man in his middle 40s, motionless, his eyes open, and clearly antipathetic to the shaded light that glowed from a lamp nearby. At our entrance, though, he did not turn his head. He began to make a low murmuring sound, whereupon my employer signaled to me to be ready to take down whatever he translated. "There," said Dr. Petra, "that is the language. I observe that it has certain repetitive sounds and constructions suggesting that he's speaking a formal language, but no one in London seems to know what it is, save that it seems very ancient." "Yes," replied Dr. Shrewsbury, "it's Rylian." Dr. Petra seemed astonished. "You know it?" "Yes. It is a prehuman language, still spoken in certain hidden places, both terrestrially and extraterrestrially." The sounds that now came from the dock worker's lips were as follows: "Penugui Cthulhu Rylie." This Dr. Shrewsbury readily translated as, "In his house at Rylie, dead Cthulhu waits dreaming." He then addressed a query to Macy, whereupon the dock worker turned his head and stared at us. Dr. Petra said that it was the first sign of cognizance he had made. The following brief conversation now ensued, Dr. Shrewsbury speaking in the same language as the dock worker. "Where were you?" "With those who serve him who is to come." "Who is he?" "Great Cthulhu. In his house at Rylie, he is not dead, but only sleeping. He shall come when he is summoned." "Who will summon him?" "Those who worship him." "Where is Rylie?" "It is in the sea." "But you were not underwater." "No, I was on the island." "Ah, what island?" "It was thrown up by the eruption of the ocean floor." "Is it part of Rylie?" "It is part of Rylie." "Where is it?" "In the Pacific Ocean near the Indies." "What latitude?" "I think it is south latitude 49 degrees, west longitude 128 degrees. It is off New Zealand, south of the Indies." "Did you see him?" "No, but he was there." "How were you brought there?" "I was taken by something in the water of the Thames one night. They brought me." "What was it?" "It was like a man, but it was not a man. It could swim in all waters. It had webbed hands, and its face was like a frog's." At this juncture, Macy began to breathe deeply, and exhaustion in Dr. Petra ended the conversation. Apologizing, but Dr. Shrewsbury brushed his apologies away, saying that he had heard enough, and making the same kind of vague explanation to Dr. Petra, which he was in the habit of making to me in the house on Kerwin Street. My employer was obviously in great haste to get away, and as soon as possible we parted from Dr. Petra and made our way on foot to a desolate section along the East India docks, where now in the darkness of night's death, Dr. Shrewsbury paused and made a strange undulate whistlings and commanded, "Hastur, Hastur, I Hastur." Then immediately our bat-winged steeds came out of the heavens, and we returned to the ancient gambrel roofs of witch-cursed Arkham. More even than the dreams themselves, the hiatus between the second and the third of this unholy trio sent me in the end to Dr. Asenath Devoto for a consultation, fearing for my sanity. For despite the fact that I was manifestly in the house of Dr. Shrewsbury on Kerwin Street, working with my employer at the preparation of some chemicals, at which he was feverishly engaged for what seemed many hours, the curious and grotesquely disturbing fact about the time between the second and third dreams was this: there did not seem to be any hiatus at all. I had lost, it seemed, the power or capacity to distinguish between dream and reality. I no longer knew which was which. For all the events of that inexplicable hiatus, however clear they seemed to me, had not the same quality as the dreams. Were we in that house on Kerwin Street, preparing those mysterious packages which Dr. Shrewsbury ultimately brought to his desk in the study? or was I caught in the mesh of a dream, so profound that I could not wake into reality? It troubled me then, though it troubles me less now. But at that time there was present in the house such an air of dire necessity, such a suggestion of terrible peril, such an urgency that food and drink, save for that strange golden mead and its effect, seemed unnecessary, and the ordinary pursuits of the day were given over to the task before us, veiled as always in that secrecy which the professor maintained in the face of everything. Dr. Devoto took all these impressions down, as he did the dreams. He made no comment on them, and circumstances made it impossible for me to see him again, for events took place with terrible swiftness after the occurrence of the third dream. I cannot be sure that that third and final cataclysmic dream took place on that night, or on some other night, or even that it did not take place by day, or that it was not in sequence a part of the second dream. All I know is that it began as before, with the arrival of Dr. Shrewsbury in my room, the summoning of the strange winged beasts which carried us, and its beginning differed only in that we were this time burdened with the packages Dr. Shrewsbury had prepared. The third and last dream, as Dr. Devoto took it down, was as follows. We were put down on a strange bleak place of utterly alien aspect. The sky was dark, forbidding. It seemed to me that fogs of a strange, unearthly green color moved eternally about us. From time to time, I had chilling glimpses of strange monolithic structures in part ruins, overgrown with seaweed, now drying, hanging limply from the superstructures before us. All around us was the sound of the sea, and the earth underfoot was of a greenish-black muck. It was earth similar to that in the cavern of my first dream. The professor made his way cautiously forward until we came to a portal, before which lay many lesser stones, from among which the professor picked up a curious stone and the shape of a five-pointed star and gave it to me, saying, "The earthquake evidently broke away the incrustation of these talismans put there by the elder gods when Cthulhu was imprisoned. This is one of the doorways to the outside." He took one of the packages and unwrapped it, and I saw that it contained explosives of singular potency. These he directed me to place strategically around the portal. Despite my awe of my surroundings, I did so. For the surroundings, whenever the mist cleared a little, were such as to leave a man breathless with wonder. The ruins, which still stood partially here and there, untouched by the quake which had caused this island to rise up from the depths, were of buildings of such vast angles and such colossal stone surfaces, and were moreover marked with such horrific hieroglyphs and impious images that I was overcome with a most intense feeling of dread. The angles and planes of this portion of the great sunken city were non-Euclidean, loathsomely suggested of the spheres and dimensions of which Professor Shrewsbury had been writing only a little while ago, of dimensions hideously apart from our own. The portal at which we worked framed a great carven door, which stood partly open, but not yet so far that it could permit entry. I do not know precisely when that door began to open, imperceptibly wider, but it was a professor who first noticed the things which were slithering over the monolithic rocks towards us from out of the sea beyond us. He had set up the apparatus necessary for the detonation which he meant to set off, and casually pointed out the scaly creatures with their webbed hands and feet and their half-human, half-frog-like features, cautioning me not to be afraid, for the five-pointed stone he had given me would protect me from them, if not from him down there. At this moment he noticed that the door seemed to stand a little wider. "Was that door so far open at first?" he asked agitatedly. I said I did not think so. "Then in heaven's name, come away." Even before I stepped back, I was conscious of two things impinging upon my senses. A charnel stench that seemed to come from the now slowly opening door, and a nasty slopping sound, a soggy sloshing, that was paralyzingly frightful. It was this latter that sent us reeling back. Dr. Shrewsbury ran for the detonator, even as the door swung wide, and a thing of abysmal horror loomed there to fill it. I cannot describe it. It was similar to the thing in the subterranean lake in the Cordillera de Vicanota in Peru, yet it was somehow more hideous, more awful, for it did not have the multiplicity of tentacles, but rather a protoplasmic formlessness which was clearly directed by an intelligence which could shape it in any way it chose. Thus, its first appearance was as a mass of doughy flesh filling the entire doorway. Then suddenly, a great malign eye appeared in its mass, and at the same time the amorphous mass began to ooze out around the doorway with an ugly, nauseatingly retching sound, accompanied by a wild fluted whistling. At that moment Dr. Shrewsbury pushed the detonator, and the stones around the portal burst asunder and heavenward before the terrible force of the explosive which Dr. Shrewsbury had brought. The monolithic pillars and slabs broke and collapsed upon the thing in the doorway. Without wasting a moment, Dr. Shrewsbury chanted his command to the winged creatures who came out of the fog-bound heavens to aid our escape from that accursed island. But we did not get away before I saw yet one thing more, even more awful than what had gone before. For the thing which had been blown to shreds by the explosion and crushed by the vast monolithic stones was reforming like water running together, shaping itself together by means of a thousand tentacles of oozing protoplasm, pushing its way with incredible rapidity over the green-black muck of the earth towards us, even as that earth began to tremble and quake, possibly as a result of the thunderous deafening detonation which may have set off subterranean rumblings to disturb the precarious existence of this island. Then we mounted the bat-winged creatures and returned to the house on Kerwin Street. It was after this dream that I sought the advice of Dr. Asenath Devoto in Boston. Certain events, prosaic enough in themselves, but with such terrible implications, had taken place that I could no longer be sure of my sanity. I had to have the assurance of a competent psychiatrist, though ironically the only immediate advice Devoto could give me, after hearing what I had to say, was to leave the house on Kerwin Street and Arkham as soon as it was possible to do so, for it was conclusively shown, he held, that Dr. Shrewsbury and his ancient house had a very bad effect on me. He made no attempt to explain the curious facts of which I grew cognizant after I awoke from that shuddersome third dream, beyond brushing them off as hallucinatory convictions which had been made to fit into my dreams after their actual occurrence, suggesting that in my somewhat abnormal state I had brought into being the physical facts which tended to show that the dreams in the house on Kerwin Street were not dreams at all, but horrible, grotesque fantasies in which I had somehow taken actual physical part. How else could I explain what had taken place and what was yet to take place? For the events following that trio of dreams now occurred with such rapidity that it was nothing short of astounding that I should not, before I have stumbled upon the key to the mystery, incredible as it was, unready as I was to accept it, or even to recognize it. Even then, perhaps, if it had not been for the agitation of Professor Shrewsbury, that profound disturbance of his equanimity, which prevented him from removing my shoes, I might not have known. For when I woke on that morning, I discovered that my shoes were covered with a greenish-black muck, the same soil as that of that hellish accursed Pacific Isle of the last dream. Not only that, but in my pocket, just where I had put it in the dream, was that strange stone in the shape of a five-pointed star, covered with hieroglyphs utterly beyond my understanding. There might, I say, have been a logical explanation of these two single factors. It could have been possible for anyone who might have had some knowledge of my dreams to have doctored my shoes and got ready such a stone, but no one could have planted the third fact, so prosaic in itself that its very mundane aspect made its appearance all the more frightful. For in the inner pocket of my coat I found a copy of the London Times, folded back to that very Freudian mystery of the dock worker we had visited, a copy of the paper of the day before, so recent that it could by no natural power on earth have reached the house on Kerwin Street. This discovery sent me to the unsatisfactory visit with Dr. Devoto, and it brought me back to confront Dr. Shrewsbury. But my employer's agitation was such that I was forestalled in what I wished to say, not only by the pallor and haggardness of his features, but by the rush of words that greeted me immediately on my return from Boston. "Where have you been, Andrew? But no matter, hurry now. Take my files down to the library of Miskatonic University. There are some future students may make good use of them." With deep astonishment, I saw that he had been going over his files in my absence and had made selections of various folders and boxes of material which he wished to remove to a more permanent setting. But his agitation and the strangeness of his manner gave me little time in which to contemplate his behavior. For having thus urged me to make all possible speed to the library with his precious documents and papers, he went about the room selecting further material to add to the growing mound in the middle of the study floor. Books, the manuscript of the first part of his second book, old texts, notes he had made from the borrowed copies of the Gnostic manuscripts, the Necronomicon, and others, particularly a sealed folio which had been labeled in his hand the Solano Fragments, and which Dr. Shrewsbury had made careful to make clear I was not to read. All the time, he alternately murmured aloud such phrases as, "I should not have taken him. It was a mistake," while he looked at me with a kind of weary commiseration, or, what was still more startling and frightening, he paused from time to time and listened, his eyes turned toward that side of the house which looked out across the street upon the shore of the Miskatonic River, as if he expected to hear the sound of his approaching doom. So unnerving was this that when I left the house I cast a furtive, fearful glance toward the river shore myself, but in the afternoon sunlight it was a reassuring sight indeed. When I returned, I found my employer standing in deep absorption before the open folio of the Solano Fragments. And once again I had evidence of a strange sensitivity, for I had come into the room very quietly, soundlessly, and his back was turned to me, yet he began to speak the moment I entered. "My only question is whether there is not danger in giving these notes to the world, though I ought not to fear that there are many who would place any credence in what I took down from these great stones. Fort is dead. Lovecraft is gone." He shook his head. I came up behind him and looked over his shoulder. My eyes fell upon what was obviously a recipe, but so strange with its strange names, that I looked to the text below. What I read there supplied another link in the damning chain of evidence, pointing to hideous possibilities in the voids of time and space, hitherto unknown to man. For there in Dr. Shrewsbury's fine script was written this legend: "The golden mead of the elder gods renders the drinker insensible to the effects of time and space, so that he may travel in these dimensions. Moreover, it heightens his sensory perceptions, so that he remains constantly in a state of bordering upon dream." This far I read before my employer closed the folio and set about sealing it once more. "The mead," I exclaimed. "Your mead?" "Yes, yes, Andrew," he said quickly. "How else did you suppose?" "But I forget. One ought not to permit one's imagination to trap one." "Imagination," I protested. "Is it imagination that I had mud from that island on my shoes this morning, and the stone in my pocket, and the London Times in my coat? I don't know. I only suspect in the light of what I've learned here how it was done. But I know we were there." He looked at me for a long moment, contemplating. Weren't we? I demanded. Even then I hoped that somehow he would have a logical, reasonable explanation to offer me. Heaven knows how eagerly I would have accepted it. But he only shook his head wearily, touched my arm as if to reassure me, and said, "Yes." And that night in June, that second night, after we were in the cave, you went back with your explosive and blasted that hellish place. I heard you scrambling down the rocks. I heard the blast. Ah, then you took some mead that night. You were in my room. I nodded. Perhaps I should have told you. But it was my error. I should not have taken you along. I was in one phase too careful, and in another too careless, assuming wrongly that you would never know. But now they have seen us. Now they know who it is blasting and sealing those doors from their eon-old borderland. He shook his head once more. Now it is too late. His tone was so ominous that for a moment I could say nothing whatever. Then a little thickly I asked, "What do you mean?" "Even now they are pursuing us. There is activity below Devil Reef off Innsmouth in the city of Yahnthale. And great beings have come from Rilye. Listen. Listen to those hellish footsteps. But I forget you cannot. You have not had your sensibilities forever made keener, as I had in those 20 years. "Yes, those 20 years, I repeated, my mind flashing back to that curiously foreboding scene in the library of Miskatonic University. "Where were you in that time?" "I was on Salerno, in that great library of ancient monolithic stones, with their books and hieroglyphs stolen from the elder gods." He stopped suddenly, cocking his head a little to one side, and after listening in that position very briefly, he began to tremble. His mouth twisted in distaste and loathing, and he turned on me with a curt order to hurry to carry the remaining material to the Miskatonic University Library, and to come back even faster, for the hour was rapidly approaching evening, and I was not to spend another night in this house. When I returned, he said, everything would be ready for my departure. So indeed it was, and the professor was more agitated than I had ever previously seen him. I have been subjected to the always maddening delay of red tape pertaining to the acceptance of Dr. Shrewsbury's books and papers, including a searching interview with Dr. Lanfer, the director of the library, who, after a glance through my first load, had asked that I be sent into his office so that he could tell me that he had ordered my employer's papers placed in the locked vault with a single rare copy of the mad Arab Abdul Azared's Necronomicon in the possession of Miskatonic University. The result of this delay was that time passed more quickly than I had thought, for it was at sundown that I returned to the house on Kerwin Street. "Good God, my boy, where were you?" demanded Dr. Shrewsbury. But he gave me no time to answer, for once again he stopped to listen, and this time I too felt what he must have felt, that powerful surging forward of an aura of age-old evil, as if the latent possibilities of the old house's atmosphere had come suddenly into maligned life. I too heard, at first only a curious water sound, as of something swimming, and then that terrible trembling of the bowels of the earth, shuddering upward from below, as if some great being walked in the watery places under the earth. "You must go at once," said my employer in a troubled voice. "You have the five-pointed stone from the island." I nodded. He seized my arm in a tenacious grip. "Do you remember the formula for summoning the interstellar creatures who serve Hastur?" Again I nodded. He took from his pocket the counterpart of the little whistle he had blown upon, and also a small phial, which I now saw contained some of that strange golden mead. "Here, then, keep this with you, and the stone too. The deep ones cannot hurt you if you carry the stone, but the stone alone is powerless against the others. Go to Boston, to New York, anywhere, but leave Arkham. Leave this accursed place. And if you hear that walker in the depths of the earth, in the waters under the earth, do not hesitate. Take the mead, keep the star by you, and repeat the formula. They will come for you. They will take you to Seleno, where I am going once again until the others will give up seeking me. But keep the stone. I did not have it, and at first they tortured me. But have no fear, they will not touch you. If you must come, I will be there. I took the field, filled with 1,000 questions I wanted to ask but could not, for the aura of the house was oppressive with terror. Its very air throbbed with menace, and from under the house came such a wave of sheer horror that all my senses cried aloud for escape. They are at the mouth of the Miskatonic now, said the professor thoughtfully, but I am ready. Some of them are coming up the river. Soon now, soon now. He turned on me once more. But go, Andrew, go! He made as if to thrust me forth, but in his sudden effort he fell sideways and struck one of the shelves nearby so that the glasses were knocked off. And what I saw then sent me screaming from that accursed house on Kerwin Street into the fog-bound darkness outside. Did I dream, too, in that frightful flight that creatures with webbed feet and hands whose great frog-like eyes gleamed phosphorescently at me out of the darkness were creeping from the waters of the Miskatonic River across the street? I did not hesitate. I did not once pause. Clutching the whistle and the phial of golden liquid close to me, I ran for my life, haunted by the sight of Professor Shrewsbury's face as I saw it in the half-darkness of that doom house. For though I had seen him read his papers and his notes, though he had described appearances, though he had given 1,000 evidences of his keen vision, above that strange second sight he seemed to have, in that maddening moment when his glasses were struck from his face, I saw, where his eyes should have been, the dark pits of empty sockets. Only a fortnight has gone by since the events I have chronicled. The house on Kerwin Street was totally destroyed by fire on the night of my wild flight, and Dr. Shrewsbury has been presumed to have perished in the Holocaust. But though I have pursued the most assiduous inquiry, I have been unable to find proof that any human bone were found in the ruins. I can only suppose that Dr. Shrewsbury somehow made his escape. It seems clear to me now, as I write, under the pressure of a fear far more terrible than that I shared with my one-time employer, that Dr. Shrewsbury had set himself upon the trail of Great Cthulhu, intent upon closing all avenues to the outside. That, I say, is a trend of such evidence as I have been able to amass. And he had learned how to utilize the strange creatures from other alien dimensions out of time and space in his pursuit of Cthulhu, intent upon saving the world he knew from enslavement to a ghastly era of eon-old evil, completely beyond the comprehension of mankind. I have looked up Seleno. It is that star in the Pleiades which lies between Alcyon and Electra on the one side and Maia and Taygeta on the other. It does not seem possible, and yet if what Dr. Shrewsbury wrote or suspected is correct, the dark lake of Holly is not far away, near Aldebaran, the abode of whom was not to be named, Hastur the Unspeakable, who has served, these ancient legends will have it, by strange bat-winged creatures who can travel in time and space. For the past few hours, here in my room in Boston, I have been trying to tell myself again, as so often I have done, that it was all a ghastly dream, one of those strange adventures of mental dislocation which sometimes happen to men, but I am no longer able to say this with much belief. For as I came home this evening from my frugal supper, I had a glimpse of a shuddersome countenance, and once more that curiously grotesque tenial illustration of the footman for the Duchess in Alice in Wonderland flashed into mine. And then those others, those web-hand creatures in the guise of men who haunted my dreams. And now surely it is not my imagination that it is responsible for the conviction that something walks beneath me in the waters of the earth, Surely I, who have never been overly blessed with imagination, cannot be dreaming this. For out of the depths beneath the house comes a terrible sucking sound, as of great protoplasmic flesh, scuffing along ponderously in a place of waters and muck. A sound like that, nasty, sloppy, nauseating slithering we heard on that hellish Pacific island just before the thing came oozing out from behind that cavernous, hideous door. I have locked my room and thrown open the window, but everywhere there is menace. I cannot turn without fear. I fancy I see those great monolithic stones with their terrible bas-reliefs looking out at me from every corner of the room, or Dr. Shrewsbury's face with those horrible pitted sockets where his eyes should have been, or the frogmen. And now that the Pleiades and Celeno are above the horizon in the northwest, I've taken the golden mead. I've gone to the window and blown upon that curiously carven whistle Professor Shrewsbury gave me in the last frantic hour together. I have stood there and called forth into the spaceless void of time his words. Hashtur, Hashtur, I, Hashtur. The footsteps continue, ghastly sloshing sounds. They seem just under the house now, and outside there is a terrible slapping sound like that made by those awful web-footed creatures that slithered toward us over the rocks on that Pacific island. But now, something, great God, wings, what beings at the window? Hastur. Epilogue from the Boston Herald for September 3rd. No further clue to the strange and remarkable disappearance of Andrew Phelan, 28, of 17th Thorough Drive, has been unearthed. It is assumed that the young man effected his disappearance voluntarily. The door of his room was locked, and though one window of his room stood open, there is no evidence to show that he dropped to the ground below or mounted to the roof. Both places have been subjected to the most minute scrutiny. No motive can be ascribed for his act. However, a cousin of Mr. Phelan expressed some doubt about his sanity at the time of his disappearance, deposing that he had seemed to be listening for sounds as of some supernatural pursuer. Since this manifestation of irrationality coincides with the strange manuscript he left behind him, it is believed that in some fashion, for reasons unknown, Mr. Phelan made away with himself.